Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia, but I'm also currently a Danish Diabetes Academy visiting professor at the University of Copenhagen. The goal of Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research, so exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, and exercise and health. And what I want is for you to get your exercise information from the world experts in research rather than influencers. Indeed, today I'm bringing to you Dr. Paul Cohen from Advent Health in Orlando, Florida, who's an expert on muscle mitochondria, exercise, and aging. So we know that mitochondrial function decreases with aging, but we talked a lot about how much of that is due to the aging itself and how much is due to physical inactivity, which tends to occur with aging. And as we'll see, physical activity can attenuate the reductions in mitochondrial function with aging. So a very important discussion. I found it really interesting. I think you will too. So stick around. Hi, Paul. Thanks for coming on. Welcome to Inside Exercise. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Glenn. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, especially at short notice, because some people would know from my background that I'm not actually in Melbourne. I'm in University of Copenhagen as a visiting professor at the moment. And I found myself suddenly short on people to interview, and you had agreed. And I was like, oh, can you come on tomorrow? And so thank you very much. Coming
absolutely. On. Absolutely. Jumped
at the chance, Glenn. Absolutely. Oh, thanks, mate. All right. So we're going to be talking about aging, mitochondrial energetics, and exercise today. But what I like to do at the start is just get a bit of a background on the person I'm chatting with. So were you like quite a lot of the people, and you look pretty fit, but I don't know the answer yet. Quite a lot of the people were sort of like myself, exercisers, and then thought, hang on, I can do this for a job, or I can learn about this. And then also some other people came the other way. What about you? How did you get into this sort of area?
Yeah, so in my teens, I cycled quite a lot. I raced bikes. And, you know, in school at the time, I was really interested in biology, human biology. And it was kind of, you know, in my teens, it was kind of a goal to try and merge those two interests in college. And so when I finished my bachelor's in bioanalytical science, and I did a master's degree as well, I decided I wanted to go study exercise physiology, to do a PhD in exercise physiology. So, and I decided I want to come across to the US to study, because, you know, the opportunities were greater than they were in Ireland at the time. You know, some of the research that was going on in some of the ex-phys labs in the US really appealed to me. So I made the jump across the pond to the US in 2003 to study for a PhD with Mike Flynn at Purdue University. And just kept going from there, basically.
Yes, so you did your PhD. So Mike Flynn is a name. I have not asked him to come on or anything yet, but I've got a long list that I'm familiar with. Why don't you tell us what you did there and then what you did afterwards? What was your focus?
So Mike's group at the time was very interested in how acute and chronic exercise can impact inflammation in older adults. He was really taken with this concept of inflammaging, that low-grade chronic inflammation by the innate immune system can contribute to age-related phenotypes, and that exercise could kind of help alleviate that. It was an anti-inflammatory effect of exercise that helped improve aging. And so we did exercise intervention studies in older adults and looked at inflammatory markers before and after. We were particularly interested in circulating markers expressed on monocytes, so these leukocytes that circulate and you know, are part of the innate immune system. We were interested in how exercise impacted expression of certain inflammatory molecules in these monocytes. And so this was a really interesting area for me, you know, coming across from Ireland and being in an exercise group focused specifically on exercise and aging was super interesting to me. So.
And is it right that I saw one of your highest impact papers was actually saying, and it might lead on to something we'll talk about later, that you know, that exercise can sort of overcome some of these situations. So people that have I think it was with aging, inflammation, etc. And it was the idea was if they were active and they weren't overweight, then they wouldn't have that problem. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The more physically active you are as you're older, as you get older, the lower these inflammatory markers are expressed. And so the thought is that being more physically active, exercising as you age, it kind of helps suppress that low-grade chronic inflammation that can contribute to pathophysiologies associated with aging.
And that'll be the interesting thing we'll talk about, because breaking down how much of the effects of aging on the mitochondria, et cetera, are just the lack of activity. But why don't we just continue on a little bit? So then you're at Advent Health, and you're working with Brett Goodpaster, and you still do. Brett was the second person to come on, so that was on the podcast.
So when I finished my PhD at Purdue, I went to University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. I did a postdoctoral fellowship there with Brett Goodpaster, focused on metabolism, exercise, obesity, with a particular focus on muscle mitochondrial energetics. And then in 2013, Brett and his group, including me, were recruited to Advent Health here in Orlando, Florida. And so, it's not a typical medical academic institute. Advent Health is a non-profit healthcare system headquartered here in Orlando, Florida. It's a hospital system that operates across 9 states in the U.S. It's the largest non-for-profit Protestant healthcare provider in the U.S. It has 50 hospitals across 9 states, has 8,200 licensed beds. And so at the time we were recruited, they were really interested in expanding their clinical translational research portfolio at the Orlando campus. And so they, and this was led by Stephen Smith. They built basically a translational research institute. This was a dedicated state-of-the-art 54,000 square foot clinical research facility that provides the infrastructure and resources for performing metabolic research studies, including outpatient research. We've got a 10-bed inpatient clinical research unit, metabolic kitchen, research dedicated MR machine, whole room calorimeters. So really state-of-the-art facility for doing clinical translational research and metabolism.
Does that mean you don't actually have to apply for like NIH grants and things as much? You get the funding through them or no?
Okay. We do receive some support from the hospital, but we absolutely have to be competitive for NIH grants.
Yes.
We also work with industry sponsors. A large portion of our revenue comes from industry-sponsored studies as well. So we can kind of attract research support from both traditional NIH support but also industry as well.
I guess you've got a lot of infrastructure there that comes from Advent Health that you don't have to.
It's really nice. We have core facilities that we can pay for certain services from our grants, and I said, it's the facility was purpose built for this kind of clinical translational research metabolism. So
all right, so in the title of the talk you've got mitochondrial energetics and you mentioned it. I think the first thing might be good to sort of go through and just say, what are we talking about? So people know about the mitochondria. You can look at it under an electron microscope and say, oh, there's the mitochondria and there's more mitochondria, or you can look at the activity of the enzymes and things. But then you've got the mitochondrial energetics, mitochondrial biogenesis, mitochondrial efficiency. Why don't you just give a bit of a background on all that, what we're actually talking about when we're talking about these things?
Yeah, so mitochondria are organelles that they're present in every cell in our body. In skeletal muscle, one of the most important functions is to produce ATP to support muscle contraction, and they do a lot of other things as well. They're involved in regulating redox stress in the cell. They're involved in cholesterol synthesis and sterol and steroid synthesis. involved in buffering cytosolic calcium as well during muscle contraction. But yeah, one of their main functions is to produce ATP, and they're a specialized organelle for doing that. And yeah, when we say mitochondrial energetics, it's really kind of describes all of the functions that go into producing ATP for the muscle cell, including electron transport, conversion of ADP to ATP at complex 5 of the electron transport chain, the TCA cycle, which occurs within the mitochondria as well. So all of those functions of the mitochondria that go into producing ATP kind of describes the term mitochondrial energetics.
Mm-hmm. And then when people talk about mitochondrial function, because I think we'll be just talking about these things. Do you want to just clarify that as well and how that fits?
Yeah, in? So, you know, the field suffers from a problem with nomenclature. It's kind of, you know, mitochondrial function is used as kind of a catch-all for oxygen consumption by the mitochondria, ATP production, ROS emission. It's kind of a catch-all term. And it's used, it can be used pretty loosely in the literature as well, which can confuse things. But mitochondrial function typically in muscle anyway, typically refers to production of ATP, but it could include other functions as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it does get a bit sort of round and around and overlapping and things, because then people talk about mitochondrial biogenesis, which is generating, you know, not so much new mitochondria, but increased volume. And, you know, you can't always assume that that's going to affect, you know, mitochondrial efficiency or maximum oxygen ATP production or whatever. So it's one of those things, like if you measure like an enzyme like PGC1 alpha and you say, oh, that's increased, it doesn't necessarily mean down track you're going to get a change in sort of function.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think mitochondrial biogenesis is the production or increase in the mitochondrial volume, the reticulum of the mitochondria is greater. And some people, some papers I've seen kind of interpret an increase in PGC1 alpha as mitochondrial biogenesis. It's a little bit removed from it, but it's related to it, but it isn't mitochondrial biogenesis per se, I think.
It might be a little bit nitty gritty, but I just think we've got to get these out of the way, because you'll be talking about effective aging on mitochondrial bioenergetics and volume and efficiency and and oxfos and all things like that. So maybe when we get to those, we can talk about it. So just generally then, what does happen with aging to the mitochondria, I guess?
Yeah, so with aging, there's generally a decrease in the capacity to produce energy in the muscle. And that's really important for maintaining physical function, to support muscle contraction for physical function for older adults. And so this decrease in the capacity to produce ATP, is largely due to decreases in mitochondrial content. But there are also other kind of dysfunctions that occur with the mitochondria and aging as well, which contribute to aging phenotypes. So, for example, it's been reported that mitochondria from muscle of older adults also produce more or release more reactive oxygen species. And that can have a detrimental effect on certain signaling pathways. There's a loss of the capacity to buffer. Sorry, my lights are going off here.
Yeah.
There's a lower capacity to buffer calcium from the cytosol as well, which kind of contributes to some dysfunctional signaling in the muscle too. There's some literature to support mitochondria being involved in apoptosis and, you know, along the
length. It's like programmed cell death. Just clarify, programmed cell death.
Programmed cell death or release of cytochrome C can activate kind of like regional apoptotic events along the length of the multinucleated fiber. So there's some evidence to support that mitochondria are involved in that, I think. So there's a myriad of changes that occur with the mitochondria as we age that contribute to lower ATP being available for muscle contraction and mobility.
So there's reductions at rest or during exercise or both. I guess you're talking about maximum, you're talking about the ability to do maximum exercise or sub-maximum or even at rest.
Well, those dysfunctions that I describe are evident at rest. They kind of limit the, they along with lower VO2 peak, they kind of limit the ability for being more physically active and exercise, the capacity, the reserve, as a physiological reserve, if you will, is lower, and so older adults are not able to exercise or be as physically active because of that.
Yeah, so I guess you just touched on VO2 max, and I saw one of your recent papers where you've said the maximum production of ATP, I think it was, in muscle, so the ATP max and the max oxphos, if maybe you can explain that, was correlated with both muscle strength and VO2 max.
Yeah.
So maybe just explain that, some of that, yeah.
Yeah, so this was data from a study I'm involved with. This is a multi-institutional study called the Study of Muscle Mobility and Aging, sponsored by the NIA. And so one of the goals of the study is to understand biological qualities of muscle that relate to walking speed, physical function, but also cardiovascular fitness or VO2 peak. One of the biological qualities of muscle that we're interested in is mitochondrial energetics. And we measure this in two ways in this study, one by magnetic resonance spectroscopy. So we used phosphorus 31, phosphorus MRS to non-invasively measure the capacity of mitochondria to produce ATP. And then the second way we did this was by doing muscle biopsies. So we biopsied the vastus lateralis, and in permeabilized fibers, we can measure oxygen consumption by the mitochondria and by the electron transport chain in the mitochondria. And so by those two measures, we're able to cross-sectionally see how they relate to other phenotypes like fitness. And so, and we had shown this before in smaller studies, but this was a pretty big study. I think we had, we recruited 879 participants in this study. But we showed that muscle mitochondrial energetics, whether it's a measure of ATP production by 31 PMRS or oxygen consumption by respirometry, we showed that it related to VO2 peak and leg power as well, which was a little bit of a surprise to us. You wouldn't expect perhaps oxidative phosphorylation to be necessarily related to the ability to produce leg power, both measures of energetics were related to VO2 peak and leg power in that study. So I think it speaks to the importance of mitochondrial energetics in terms of physical fitness as we age.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So when you, just to clarify for people that aren't sure about what MRS is, etc. So when you go in like a scanner. People would be filling them with CAT scans and things like that. Basically, they've got they look at your in vivo. So in vivo in your muscle, they can look at this phosphorus 31. So it's like an isotope, and they can basically work out the changes. Now, because I remember doing this years and years and years ago. Yeah. We do like calf contractions, and then you look at the resynthesis of creatine phosphate. Is that what you do?
Yeah, that's it. So the participant lies in an MR scanner, like it's a massive donut. Mm-hmm. They basically lie in the middle of it, and we strap their ankle to the bench, and so they they kick, these are isometric contractions, they kick against the strap for 20 to 30 seconds. And in the thigh, we measure the depletion of phosphocreatine across those 20 to 30 seconds. And then when they stop, phosphocreatine is replenished, it's resynthesized, and we're able to model that a resynthesis curve, and we're able to deduce the capacity of the mitochondria to produce ATP in that process of
Because the resynthesis is aerobic.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it just so happens the person I had on, not last, but before the second last, was Brad Schoenfeld. And we're talking about resistance training for hypertrophy, et cetera. And we know, we just touched on the fact that, you know, even with, you know, weight training, it's very, you know, very mainly anaerobic exercise. You've got that, the recovery is aerobic. So that's basically what you're doing with the calf there, aren't you? So you're doing hard contractions. So the quicker it recovers, basically, the higher the ATP max rate is. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you found that correlated with both VO2 max, so whole body VO2 max, and I said strength before, but leg power. And also I'm interested, how do they, so that's an in vivo measure, but then correct, you've got the permolyzed muscle fibers bundles. So where you do a muscle biopsy, yeah, and you permolyze these fiber bundles, and then you measure their oxygen consumption when you stimulate them with various things, ADP, et cetera. Yeah. And how do they actually correlate with each other?
Yeah, they correlate quite well. Yeah, as you would expect, they're both measures of mitochondrial function, both slightly different aspects of mitochondrial function, but they correlate quite well. And, you know, we chose those two methodologies because they're complementary to each other. You know, the in vivo stuff is, you're measuring mitochondria, you know, with the normal physiological blood supply to the muscle. You know, there's the neuromuscular stimulation involved there. There's calcium flux in the cytosol. Whereas with the respiration, it's in a chamber, really well controlled in terms of supply of oxygen substrates. There's no calcium flux, there's no neuromuscular activation. And so you're really just, it's kind of a reductive process, right? Going from the in vivo to the in vitro. Yep. We're looking specifically at the electron transport chain function under highly controlled conditions. So they kind of complement each other in that way. And like you said, yes, as we would expect, they correlate with each other too.
And the nice thing, I guess, is you can break it down a bit and stimulate them with different substrates and things like that. You know, like
absolutely. Yes.
And look at the different
electron transport chain with different substrate combinations, carbohydrate versus or in combination with fatty acids. You can inhibit various components of the electron transport chain to get complex specific supported respiration as well. So
and this is getting a bit nitty-gritty perhaps, but there's a bit of a debate sometimes, permolyzed fibers versus like isolated mitochondria. What's the go with that? I mean, obviously you lean towards the permolyzed fibers.
I mean, I think it depends on the question you're asking. You know, if you're interested in how mitochondria per se might be impacted by you know, an intervention, then, you know, isolating the mitochondria and assaying the mitochondria in an isolate is a better way to look at the mitochondria per se independent of content. But if you're interested in, you know, preserving that reticular structure in the muscle, and you're interested in changes in function and content, then, you know, assaying in the fibers and also markers of content as well, I think is the way to go. You know, there's some evidence. You know, Martin Picard, who is he's a fellow mitochondriac. He published some really interesting work showing that, you know, in isolated mitochondria, it can exacerbate the apparent age effects on mitochondrial dysfunction, including ROS emission and you know, inability to buffer calcium. So those papers by Martin really kind of, you know, put a question mark over whether we should be using isolated mitochondria or not. And the idea of preserving the reticular structure of the mitochondria in permeabilized fiber bundles, at the time appealed more. So, those are some of the thinking behind why we chose to go with the permeabilized fiber approach.
All right. So that's great having all that background. So now I'm interested to kind of the thing we touched on earlier, like how much the changes, I'm sure it's hard to say black and white, but how much of the changes with aging, I guess you try and stratify things. If you have 689 people, you could probably look at ones that were sort of fitter and ones that were less fit. And I don't know. So how much of it is the lack of activity and how much is the aging, and is that hard to separate?
Yeah, that's a great question, Glenn. You know, a lot of the earlier papers which showed decreases in mitochondrial function and content with aging, they're wonderful studies, but they didn't, you know, a lot of them didn't control for physical activity, didn't control for comorbidities with aging. So a lot of our older population are suffering from comorbidities that can impact physical function and thus mitochondrial health. Adiposity, so as we get older, you know, we tend to put on weight, and that as well can impact mitochondrial function. So yeah, the question of whether mitochondrial function decreases with age per se in humans, you know, I think we're starting to understand that, you know, lower physical activity and increased adiposity plays a big role in that apparent decrease with aging. And yeah, so in the SOMA study, that's one thing we're hoping to get at a little more closely. With such a large number of participants, we can do kind of, you know, more nested case control type studies to look at how, you know, well-matched younger versus older individuals, while controlling for physical activity and adiposity, kind of understanding how, you know, age per se might impact mitochondrial function.
Is it fair to say that you're actually controlling for that in a way? Because I guess when you look at your mitochondrial function, mitochondrial energetics, et cetera, you're looking at per unit of muscle or per unit of mitochondria. So I remember the classic sort of Fleming Dealer papers showing that people with type 2 diabetes had reduced mitochondrial function. But when he, you know, when he said, looked at it per unit of mitochondria, it was normal. Is it fair to say, or, you know, how does that work with aging?
Yeah, I think a lot of the reduced capacity to generate ATP and to consume oxygen in the electron transport chain, I think those decreases with aging, I think a lot of it is explained by reduced mitochondrial content. You know, that said, there are other aspects of mitochondria that can contribute to the aging, including ROS emission and dysfunctional calcium handling as well. And you know
are they sort of partially normalized as well? I guess you'd said that earlier a bit with the, yeah. So again, if you, per unit of mitochondria, as the reactive oxygen species increase production and things like that, is that also attenuated somewhat?
No, it's kind of the opposite. The lower mitochondria you have, the more likely there's greater ROS production from the mitochondria.
Oh yeah, sorry, I confused myself there. What I was saying is, you know, we're saying per unit of mitochondria, with aging, if you keep your mitochondria up, things are looking better. Is it the same with reactive oxygen species? If you maintain your mitochondrial volume, I'm assuming the reactive oxygen species production isn't as bad as well.
Right, correct, yes.
Yep. Okay, cool. All right, so with, I'm interested in like acute and chronic exercise. So I remember we did a bit of mitochondrial stuff a few years ago now, but it was more looking at mitochondrial biogenesis and things. We did some measurement of mitochondrial function. But I remember at the time, you know, you mentioned that your measurements are made at rest, apart from the in vivo, you know, if you're doing the isolated muscle bundles. And I was thinking, well, it'd be nice if you could sort of do it during exercise or try and mimic the exercise environment or something. You know, like for example, this phosphorylation and all sorts of stuff that happens during exercise. Is there any way you can sort of, I don't actually know. Is there any way you can try and get to what's happening during exercise? I guess you're doing that with your MRS stuff, right?
You mean how acute exercise impacts?
Well, how acute exercise. So if you do acute exercise and you do a biopsy and you get those permeabilized muscle fibers and you stick them in your Ouroboros or whatever, You've lost that environment that was there during exercise. So is there any way you can try and, you know, like if this phosphorylation of proteins or whatever, you can try and keep them phosphorylated? Or if there's like a, you know, creatine phosphate to creatine ratio, whatever, you can try and keep that, you know, is there any way to sort of, or is it not really?
No, I think it's a good question. I think the MRS approach is probably, 31P MRS approach is probably a good one to answer that, whether acute exercise can kind of activate the mitochondria or, you know, keep them activated. And you can see that with MRS after the acute bout. We've done this in permeabilized fiber bundles, and we really don't see much of a difference in mitochondrial energetics after acute exercise.
But have you tried to sort of mimic the environment or try and keep things how they were, or you just get the muscle and everything just washes away, I guess, when you're separating out the bundles and all that?
Yeah. Certainly from the cytosol, whatever's in the cytosol washes out, but there could well be retained changes within the mitochondria that are preserved. Another way to do this is, I think it was Martin Brown published papers a couple of years ago where he tried to formulate recipes like buffers within which you would measure mitochondrial respiration. But the buffers mimicked the metabolic milieu of rest and exercise. And so that's another kind of maybe approach to take, is to try and mimic the metabolic milieu of rest and exercise muscle ex vivo in the respirometry chamber.
What I was probably getting at. I sort of stumbled around there because we did a bit with that when we were measuring ADP activity at one stage. I think it was, we were like you're always doing maximum ADP, but it's like, well, what about if you adjust the ADP and things like that to try and fit what it is during exercise. Yeah. All right, this is really interesting. So when we talk about with aging, you get reductions in mitochondrial energetics and function, et cetera. What are we talking about? So, you know, I tend to take a lot of people, I tend to take more interest as I get older. So when you're talking about aging, is it, you know, like with strength, things are okay, and then you hit 50 and it drops off and things like that. What, do we know the sort of time course with the mitochondria? Like if people are okay until what, 30, 40, or, you know, if they're not exercising, I guess I'm saying.
Yeah. It's similar to the loss of strength and, you know, cardiovascular fitness that you see with aging. You get to, you know, 50, 60, 70. And again, it depends on how physically active you are during those years as well. But yeah, there's a gradual decline. And then after 70, it probably gets a little steeper as it goes down. But again, it's, you know, maybe not aging per se, maybe it's, you know, that correlates more with increased physical inactivity and adiposity. You know, we've done studies where we've matched the oldest 80 plus and matched for, you know, physical activity and adiposity, and their mitochondria don't seem too bad, actually. They respire quite well. And so I think there's still more work that needs to be done there, Glenn, to understand, you know, factors other than chronological age that impact that trajectory of decline with as we get older.
So it certainly seems that way with a lot of things, not just the mitochondria, but that if you keep physically active or even physically active is quite a broad, you know, people might say, oh, 10,000 steps or, you know, whatever. But if you're actually exercising, so, for example, I had Ben Levine on, and he said, you know, walking he felt was not really enough to, you know, even though it has metabolic benefits, it's not really enough for your cardiovascular function. So I guess that's what I was getting at there. I guess what do we know about that? So is walking enough to maintain your mitochondria, or do you think you need to do more?
Yeah, we've done so with Brett at the University of Pittsburgh, we did a physical activity intervention in individuals who had just had bariatric surgery. So we were interested in understanding how physical activity on top of surgery-induced weight loss impacted metabolic health, including mitochondrial function and muscle. So the intervention was largely walking. These individuals, that, I mean, they're so deconditioned that walking is kind of their exercise. It's exercise. Mm-hmm. But this walking intervention, we saw improvements in mitochondrial energetics with 6 months of the intervention that correlated with improvements in additional improvements in insulin sensitivity on top of what was gained through weight loss after the surgery. So
that was New England Journal of Medicine, wasn't it? It was a very, JCI. Journal of Clinical Investment. That's very nice. I saw you had a couple of those.
Yeah.
I wonder if it depends on where you start off. So, you know, people that aren't morbidly obese or whatever, as they're getting older, I'm sure they're still losing their mitochondria and maybe they've got to do a bit more, or it's maybe relative to your VO2 max, for example.
Relative to where you start from, you know, I think you need to kind of enter your older years with as much reserve capacity in your mitochondria as possible. Because it will eventually start to decline, but the more you have to begin with through physical activity or exercise, I think the better off you're going to be as you get older.
I was going to say it's amazing how these things fit with other chats I've had with people, but it makes sense because we're so integrative. You know, when I first started my master's and PhD, we're thinking of all these systems as separate, but now we know how integrative things are. So same with Michael Joyner. He was like, he wants to get, he's 65, he wants to get his maximum sort of muscle he can before he's 70, because then it's going to like drop off. And you're probably saying the same with mitochondria. And then we're talking about also, I had Wendy Cordon talking about bone mass, you know, and you want to get as much as you can before it drops off. You know, that's a lot earlier, but it makes sense because we're so, you know, the body's so integrative. Like, why would you have sun systems that are like, you know, just all this reserve that you don't need, and then other systems that you know.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. Yeah, you have to have a kind of an integrative physiology mindset when you're studying, you know, your niche interest. If it's mitochondrial energetics, I think it's important to understand that it also relates to vascular function in the muscle. It also relates to cardiopulmonary function. You know, it's related to physical activity, adiposity, so on and so forth. So, it is interesting.
I guess we haven't talked as well with Brett Goodpaster and yourself looking at the different fats and muscle and, you know, the ceramides and the diacylglycerols. And so how's that looking in terms of playing a role maybe in changes with age as well?
Yeah. So, you know, you talked about this when you had Brett on about how diacylglycerols and ceramides are thought to contribute, along with other factors, to insulin resistance and muscle, and you know, how that's, you know, important in the, you know, in diabetes and pre-diabetes. But, you know, we also believe it's potentially related to aging phenotypes as well, not just insulin resistance, but, you know, muscle mass and the ability to hypertrophy. So I think there's evidence that suggests that ceramides are also involved in, kind of blunting this ability of muscle to hypertrophy, or, you know, the anabolic response to exercise and food. You know, there's some evidence to suggest that ceramides are kind of involved in those processes too. And so, you know, I think that's interesting and obviously relevant to aging and muscle health.
Is it your lights go out when you're not moving enough?
Yeah, the indirects from my grants, they run out and they cut the lights off straight away here.
Oh, is that what that is? Okay.
Funny.
All right. So the other thing I was thinking about is it's easy to talk about just mitochondria, but, you know, some people listening will probably know that there's different types of mitochondria within muscles. So there's the subsarcolemma, which is sort of just underneath the membrane on the outside of the cell. Sorry, you've got the cell membrane, and then just underneath that within the cell, you've got the subsarcolemma mitochondria, but then you've got the intramyofibrillar mitochondria. I wonder if we know, you know, and there's, you know, some evidence that they're altered by exercise and by diabetes and things. Do we know what's happening with age there? Is there any sort of...
There's some evidence that suggests that subsarcolemma mitochondria are maybe more susceptible to... decreasing with age, there's some pretty decent evidence to support that. And the reciprocal as well with exercise, you know, with exercise, subsarcoelemmal mitochondria seem to be more responsive to exercise interventions in terms of mitochondrial biogenesis. And so there's evidence supporting both of those, I think. And, you know, it's really interesting to think, you know, functionally about how they might differ as well, subsarcoelemmal versus intramyofibular. There's some really interesting data over the last few years from Brian Glancy's work and Bob Balaban at NIH, where, you know, they suggest that subsarcoelemmal mitochondria are maybe better at generating they're slightly more specialized at generating the membrane potential necessary for producing ATP at complex five, whereas intramyofibular mitochondria are maybe a little more specialized at generating ATP from the membrane potential. And so the idea is that subsarcoelemmal mitochondria generate the membrane potential. It flows into through the reticular structure, flows to the intramyofibular mitochondria, which are, again, a little more specialized at generating ATP. And so this is kind of really interesting work, like I said, from Brian Glancy's lab, showing how these two populations might work together to...
So they work together.
Okay. Yeah, work together to kind of efficiently produce energy for the muscle.
So even though they're in different parts, so make I'll just make sure people are clear. This is all within the one muscle fiber. So we're not talking about sort of all over the place. Yeah. So they interact with each other within the one fiber. That's interesting. Because I guess the other thing is, you know, they are a reticulum. They're not just a, you know, you do this sectioning and you see these little things and you think they're just little sausages.
So the, you know, the classic textbook depiction of a mitochondria is this little egg-shaped organelle. And like you said, a lot of that comes from just looking at it in two dimension through cross sections, either by immunofluorescence or electron microscopy. But these new techniques now that allow us to generate 3D renderings of the mitochondria actually shows that these little egg shape, the egg over here is actually connected to the egg over here through this reticulum. So it's really a reticular structure. And you know, through the reticulum, membrane potential can flow back and forth, and and you know, the degree of interaction between the, you know, the reticulum is it's different from cell type to cell type as well, and but it's a really kind of interesting aspect of mitochondrial physiology that was really brought to light by these 3D structural renderings and in muscle from Brian Glancy's work.
Yeah, I wanted to think, it's very interesting. I wanted to talk some more about this, you're doing the study of muscle mobility and aging, SOMA, that you said with the 689 participants or whatever, which is amazing. So it's a multi-center. I just want to talk some more about, because you're saying relationship with leg power as well as the VO2max. I know we touched on that earlier. What do you think's going on there? I know you said it was a bit surprising. And you're also looking at mobility. So what are you finding there with
So we see that you know, we've reported pilot data in the past linking mitochondrial energetics in muscle to physical function and mobility in older adults, and that was, you know, Luigi Ferrucci at NIA and the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging. He also kind of he followed up and showed it as well, showed similar relationships. And so SOMA, we're kind of getting into it, you know, in an even more deep level here. And so we're seeing that mitochondrial energetics in muscle, it's an important aspect of muscle to facilitate muscle contraction and keep older adults mobile as they grow older. And, you know, an older adult who suffers from mobility disability, that's a huge consequence on a person's health as they age. You know, risk factors for all kinds of bad things go through the roof if an older adult becomes immobile. And so, you know, the idea here is maybe we can, you know, target drugs to help mitochondrial energetics in these older adults and keep them more mobile as they grow older.
Or you can just try and get them to exercise. But I know that's hard. It's we all know that people exercise. I think everyone knows they should exercise, but they don't necessarily do it, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, there's evidence to support that, you know, perhaps older adults with certain comorbidities like diabetes, maybe they don't respond as well, or they take longer to respond to exercise. And so, you know, I know the exercise mimetics is a kind of controversial idea, like, you know, it kind of polarizes people's, thoughts, whether, you know, why don't you just go out and exercise? You don't need a pill to, but I think there are certain cases where, you know, having an adjunct to exercise or physical activity can be beneficial. And so certain patient populations in older adults, I think that's the case.
But I guess we know how integrative exercise is. So it'd be hard to, even if you can get a medication that increases your mitochondrial function or something, if you don't have the cardiovascular function or the other things, then, that's the hard part.
Exercise and a pill, it's far too multifaceted to be able
exactly.
to generate a pill that replicates.
Maybe we should talk about, rather than exercise pill, maybe we should talk about little bits of the exercise.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
pill. Now, maybe I was just thinking, it probably makes sense in a way that if you're more able to contract your muscles generally and produce energy generally, so your mitochondrial function, it probably makes sense that your leg power would sort of go along with it, because you're actually able to, now as you get older, you're actually active and your muscles wouldn't be sort of wasting away as much. So you'd maybe end up with more leg power. Does that make sense?
No, I think so. And yeah, it was interesting that we saw relationships between respiration and leg power, because, you know, the leg power test, it's a leg extension and it's one contraction that the participant makes. And so, you know, when you think about the energy system involved in that one contraction, it's going to be, you know, phosphocreatine and maybe not oxidative phosphorylation.
No.
And so why would respiration relate to leg power? And, you know, we think perhaps there's other aspects of mitochondrial function at play here. Calcium buffering during contraction could be a potential. We didn't measure this, but we're just hypothesizing that, you know, perhaps improved calcium handling by the mitochondria might be something that relates to leg power. And
you also had in there, it said fitness, leg power, fatigue, sex differences. So did you do a fatigue measure and were there, and then maybe talk about that, and then we can talk about sex differences if there were any.
Yeah. So the fatigue part of SOMA has been led by Nancy Glynn at the University of Pittsburgh. And so we measured perceived fatigue, but we also measured performance fatigue, where we actually kind of objectively measure the fatigue, because fatigue is kind of a psychological construct, if you will. But we measured both ways, subjective and more objectively. And yeah, we see that mitochondrial energetics is related to an older adult's fatigue levels, both perceived and performance fatigue during a walking test. So again, that's another interesting aspect of muscle mitochondrial energetics linking to an important phenotype for aging. Fatigue is a big, it's one of the reasons why older adults aren't more physically active or don't engage in exercise, because they feel tired. And so, yeah, we saw those relationships as well in SOMA. We haven't published this data yet. We're kind of just getting manuscripts out the door at the moment. So this is unpublished work. And then in an analysis plan led by Phil Kramer, who's at the Wake Forest University, he's also involved in SOMA, he's seen differences in mitochondrial energetics between males and females, and particularly between an age range of I think it's 70 and 80. Between that age range, women tend to have lower mitochondrial energetics in their muscle, and it seems to relate to lower physical function in women at that in that age range as well. And so this is really interesting stuff because older women tend to suffer from loss of physical function and mobility disability earlier, and it's more prevalent compared to men. And so we think that this discrepancy in mitochondrial energetics between men and women it kind of explain at least some of that sex difference in
I wasn't aware of that. So they have earlier reductions in mitochondrial function by energetics, even though they live longer.
Yes.
Average. Okay. So again, I'm sounding like a broken record, but how much of all this is, again, activity versus age? So, you know, I'm just trying to think through it more. So, you know, when you look at the correlations, so the ones that are more active will have a higher VO2 max, maybe a higher leg power, and maybe because they're more active, they'll be more mobile. You know, is the reason these things all line up because it's, if you're physically active, they, you know, then you have high levels of everything. If you're inactive, you have low levels of everything.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how you separate it out. I know I'm just like a broken record, but it's hard stuff. But
No, these are great questions, Glenn. And we can control for it. So we did measure objective physical activity using accelerometers. We used Actigraph accelerometers and ActiPal. So we have they're really well phenotyped in terms of physical activity. So we can kind of statistically control for that in our multivariate regression models as well.
Okay, that's important to come out because I guess I hadn't quite got that. So you're saying when you do allow for all that, you are definitely seeing with age there is reductions independent of the physical activity.
We haven't answered that very question. Now you're going from, you know, sex differences to age per se. We haven't answered that yet. We're in the process. That's another analysis plan that we're kind of working through at the moment.
Okay, all right.
Be able to answer the question, is it aging per se or is it adiposity and physical activity that mediate this apparent decrease with aging?
Okay. Now, another paper I saw of yours, you were first author in 2013, talking about in addition to aerobic capacity, lower mitochondrial capacity and efficiency likely play roles in slower gait speed with age. Now, this is one that I heard, and I haven't really kept up on it, but for a while there, people were saying, you know, you can look at all your cardiovascular risk factors and things like, you know, cholesterol and, you know, insulin resistance, et cetera. But then there was a talk about how just looking at your waist circumference, for example, was almost as good at predicting your, you know, mortality. And then it became your gait speed. I'm not sure if that's still, is that still sort of something that people say that your gait speed is a good indicator of, I think they were talking about your likelihood of dying in the next 5 years type of thing. And does that relate to the mitochondria as well?
Yeah. There have been a number of large epidemiological studies now that have shown that gait speed can predict, in older adults, gait speed can predict morbidity and mortality, can predict falls, it can predict hospitalization. So it's a really good kind of easy to measure metric of, you know, I guess it's, you know, an aspect of healthy aging. But again, yeah, it's, you know, it's, I think it's more, obviously more relevant to older adults than younger adults. Whereas, waist circumference and those other metrics you measure, cholesterol would be relevant to everyone. I think walking is maybe more specific to our older population. And again, it's obviously, you know, before a person becomes immobile, they tend to slow down somewhat. And so, you know, your walk speed can predict your mobility disability as you get older. And again, that's a huge health challenge for older adults. Once they're immobile, then, you're at really great risk for other comorbidities.
Absolutely. Actually, I mentioned Brad Schoenfeld earlier. I'm talking about muscle hypertrophy. And he, very early on, he said if there was one thing you were going to do, exercise-wise, he would say weight training. And I was sort of like, because, you know, I'm more like an endurance type person. Yeah. I tend to think, you know, when you talk about We looked at the effect of exercise on glucose uptake or mitochondrial function. The assumption is that it's endurance type exercise. But he was saying that, you know, if he was going to say one thing for people to do as they got older, he would say weight training ahead of aerobic. I wonder, I'm kind of throwing this at you out of left field, but what do you think? What would you say with that?
I mean, yeah, I think
obviously, you know, both would be better. Sorry, both would be better. And that's yeah.
Yeah, but if you have to choose one over the other, I think they're both good. I mean, I think they both elicit you know, slightly distinct benefits to health as we get older. You know, aerobic or endurance exercise, you know, maybe improves oxidative capacity of the muscle. You know, it might improve VO2 peak. And so you've got a greater aerobic capacity. You have a greater capacity to do more work. And then, you know, resistance exercise is going to help improve power, strength. And so, you know, they're distinct benefits to both.
And has metabolic benefits as well, like increases in some sensitivity.
Well, absolutely. Yes, has metabolic benefits as well. You know, balance training is another one that we, you know, you never really hear about, but that's another important, you know.
Reduce falls and things like that, I guess.
Yeah, intervention for overdose or activity is to do balance training to reduce falls. You know, I'd say, you know, you can recommend one, but I think the best type of exercise is the exercise that someone will adhere to.
Exactly.
And this is kind of like personalized medicine, is you really have to kind of get to know the patient or participant. And, you know, if they like dancing, then encouraging them to go, you know, go dancing. You know, if they don't want to go to the gym and lift weights, they're not going to. So, yeah.
Exactly. That's come across over and over and over. We start talking about, you know, should they do this or that? And it's just try and get them out there doing something.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, and, you know, if we are going to have...
One of the other benefits exercises as you get older as well, I think, you know, social isolation is a huge problem for older adults. And I think we're increasingly recognizing that as a major factor for mental health in aging too. So, you know, exercise that involves, you know, group activities and social interaction, I think is an aspect of exercise that we should consider when we're making recommendations for older adults too. Yeah, I think that's important to consider.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if we're talking about healthy aging, I think we interacted a bit before we came on air about some questions on Twitter. Yes. Yeah, so thinking about, are we thinking here, there's a lot of hype on Twitter and things, and some sort of famous people that are saying that longevity, you can live forever, and aging is a disease and you should be able to stop it and things like that. I'm assuming that you're not necessarily thinking like that. You're thinking that exercise maybe prolong a few years of your life, but is it more health span? You're not suggesting if people exercise, they'll live to 150.
No, I don't think so. I think we need to be, you know, focused on health span and physical activity and exercise can definitely improve health span as we get older. There's no doubt about that. And you know, I don't think there's any argument around that. And I think that's kind of where we should kind of focus.
You're not writing books saying that you can stop aging.
No,
it's just it's been all over Twitter and every second person I talk to says I should be interviewing this type of person. But
it's interesting. It's you know, I think there's a lot of hype around some of that stuff that you're talking about, and you know, I don't think we know what aging is, to be honest. You know, I don't think we understand the basic biology of aging well enough to, you know, there's a lot of interest around senescence now and senolytics and I don't know whether they're going to actually improve longevity. I think it's more likely, you know, this is ridiculous. I need to do something about light here.
That's all right. We have a quick look at the view and you're, so you don't have to take NAD or NMN and you'll live forever.
Those, you know, there's I think there's potential for, you know, for NAD boosters to you know, help with health span. I'm not sure about longevity though. And you know, same for senolytics. You know, I think we should.
What is that? Can you just explain what that is?
These are compounds that help help the body remove senescent cells. These are kind of zombie cells that are kind of, you know, they're not proliferating, and they're engaged in production of proteins that are, you know, inflammatory and kind of contribute to, you know, bad metabolism as we get older.
Yeah. All right. So from Twitter here, I've got Mark. Is healthy aging possible with a chronic disease if the disease is well managed, or do you need to stay disease-free, e.g. to avoid sarcopenia?
Yeah, that was a good question. And I actually, you know, I actually Googled the definition of healthy aging. And so the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's their definition for healthy aging is the development and maintenance of optimal physical, mental, and social well-being and function in older adults. And so can you have healthy aging if you have a well-controlled disease? I think it's possible to be, you know, to have healthy aging with a well-managed disease, I think. I mean, it's kind of a matter of opinion, you know, more than medical fact. I don't think healthy aging, from the definition that I understand it, it doesn't necessarily mean disease-free. Maintenance of optimal physical, mental, and social well-being and function in older adults. So
it's optimal. It depends on the disease as well. So if you've got diabetes, we know that exercise and diet can improve that, and I guess you would have more healthy aging than if you didn't do that.
Yeah, exactly.
He also asked, Mark also asked, are there any objective measurements, surrogate markers associated with healthy aging, e.g. fat max, leg press 1.5 times body weight, high VO2 max, etc.?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's some very specific examples there. You know, I'd say, you know, I think a higher VO2 max is definitely going to be associated with healthy aging, you know, greater strength, leg strength, grip strength, you know, your ability to maintain function, walk speed. All of those are kind of clinical markers associated with healthy aging, along with, you know, kind of traditional clinical markers like cholesterols, blood glucose. I think all of these are going to be really associated with healthy aging.
Yeah, and some of the clinical things they do, I guess, are like 6-minute walk test and things like that, sort of brings together some of these things. All right. Well, I think this has been really interesting. What I also wanted to talk to you about was you sent me through a couple of other things you've been working on that I was going to ask, you know, what is there anything you're doing at the moment you're really excited about? I mean, some of the things you said already sound exciting, but you talked about inherited and acquired mitochondrial DNA sequence, et cetera. Did you want to talk about that? And also you've got some nitrate work and anything you want to talk about?
So kind of spinning off on the mitochondrial theme and aging muscle, we, you know, a couple of collaborators and I, James Delaney, who's here at TRI, and Greg Trenaugh, who's at University of California, San Francisco, we recently got a grant funded to study how mitochondrial DNA sequence variation in aging muscle impacts mitochondrial function and physiological function. And so this is really exciting for us. We're going to be able to look at how inherited and acquired mitochondrial DNA sequence variation impacts mitochondrial function. So for example, inherited sequence variation, like haplogroups. So these are kind of ancient specific mutations that that evolved over time. And so these haplogroups are kind of associated with where humans evolved from. So, you know, mitochondrial haplogroup in Ireland, for example, might be different from someone in Africa. And
what do you mean by a haplogroup? Do you want to just clarify that?
These are inherited combinations of sequence variation that basically evolved as humans migrated over thousands of years, that evolved as humans migrated across the planet. And these are markers of genetic ancestry, basically. And so we're interested in how these sequence variations, inherited sequence variations, impact mitochondrial function in the SOMA study. So again, we'll have, you know, a wealth of mitochondrial phenotyping data to relate the genetics data to.
And what's the inherited and then acquired? Is that more sort of epigenetic, or what are you thinking there with the acquired?
Yeah, not epigenetic. So, you know, over the course of our life, our mitochondrial DNA, they acquire mutations in part due to, you know, exposure to oxidative stress. And so this accumulation of mutations can reach a threshold which can impact mitochondrial function. And so we're interested in understanding how the degree of acquired mutations can impact mitochondrial function and muscle health and aging.
And also you've got one, these aren't specifically exercise, I guess, but role of nitrate supplementation on muscle energetics in aging.
Yeah, so this is a collaboration with Daniel Foreman at the University of Pittsburgh. Dan is a geriatrician and cardiologist. And so we're conducting a randomized controlled trial to understand how oral nitrite supplementation might impact mitochondrial energetics and aging. It's a muscle biopsy study. We're measuring mitochondrial energetics before and after nitrite or placebo intervention, and you know, we're hypothesizing that nitrite might improve mitochondrial biogenesis or efficiency, and that in turn might relate to improvements in exercise efficiency or physical function in these older adults.
So it's the nitrite. So just so people know that when you ingest nitrate, there's bacteria in your mouth that convert it to nitrite, and you're thinking the nitrite will then affect the mitochondrial. I know there's been discussion of that, but maybe people haven't looked specifically at aging, I guess.
They haven't looked specifically at aging. And, you know, one of the novel aspects of this is that our nitrate supplement elicits kind of high bioavailability. I think the literature suffers from, you know, prior studies that have investigated oral nitrite or nitrate, the bioavailability hasn't been, you know, super great, but this oral nitrate supplement that we're using elicits a pretty high bioavailability in the plasma. And you know, this is work that kind of spins off work that Mark Gladwin had done at the University of Pittsburgh as well. So you know, Mark's as you know, a leader in the field of nitric oxide biology, and so he's involved in this as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that so it's not just a beetroot, it's not a strength. What is it when you beetroot juice that's been what am I trying to say here? You know, no, the beta shots that we've used those as well.
Yeah, no, they're really effective.
Concentrated,
actually.
That's the word, concentrated. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's not a concentrated beetroot juice. This is kind of it's in a pill form. The concentrated beetroot juice works really well too. I mean, that's that you know, elicits a high level of nitrate in the blood.
Yeah, I've done a bunch of nitric oxide stuff over the years. So we did a nitrate ingestion study with the concentrated beetroot juice. Okay, and then the last one you sent through was impacts of pre-diabetes insulin resistance on trajectory of response to bed rest and recovery in older adults. What are you looking at there? What's your main focus on that one?
Yeah, so we're doing a bed rest study here at TRI. You know, the bed rest is it causes muscle loss. There's muscle atrophy, loss of strength, and it induces, insulin resistance in muscle as well. And so this is really relevant for older adults who are, for example, hospitalized. They're quite often end up resting in bed for an extended period of time. Older adults are more likely to be hospitalized than younger adults. Older adults, when they're hospitalized, it's for a longer duration when compared to younger adults. And they often suffer from comorbidities that could exacerbate the negative effects of bed rest. And so this study is really focused on pre-diabetes and diabetes and how those conditions might worsen the trajectory of muscle loss and delay recovery following bed rest. So we're taking these older adults, we're putting them to bed with and without pre-diabetes or diabetes, and we're putting them to bed for 10 days. We do all kinds of metabolic phenotyping before and after, and then we're monitoring the loss of muscle mass, but also following them afterwards. So we, they get a medical check after 10 days of bed rest, and they're safe to go home. But we have them come back in every week to the clinic once a week for 4 weeks, and we measure muscle mass, function, and metabolism, and look at that trajectory of recovery. So we're hypothesizing that older adults with pre-diabetes or diabetes, it takes them a little longer to recover. That their muscle maybe isn't as responsive to recovery following a period of bed rest. And, if that's the case, then obviously it has implications for, our older adult population who suffer from diabetes. And, older adults with diabetes are more likely to be hospitalized as well. So so there's some, real clinical relevance to the study. And at the same time, we're doing muscle biopsies in these individuals too. So I think the data from this study will provide some clinically interesting data for hospitalized patients. But also we're looking at how mitochondrial energetics and changes in lipid metabolism contribute to the muscle atrophy phenotype as well. So we're kind of getting the biology of it too.
That does sound really important work, because as we know, you this drop off in mitochondrial function or strength or whatever it is sort of goes down steadily, but when you have it's a bed rest, sick for a few weeks, it drops and then it doesn't get back again. Unless you exercise, maybe.
Unless you exercise, exactly. Yes, exactly. And it's not just, it goes back to the integrative physiology that we talked about earlier. Bone mineral density decreases with bed rest, and mitochondrial energetics and fitness and insulin sensitivity. So it's the whole kind of integrative physiology of metabolic health kind of is impacted by bed rest. And like you said, older adults maybe don't recover as well as younger adults, and it kind of contributes to the overall decline with aging.
And do you have a younger group control? I might have missed that. Do you have
No, we don't. So the control group is a group of older, metabolically healthy individuals. So we're really interested in understanding how within older adults, metabolic health impacts the response to bed rest.
Okay. All right. Well, this has been great. Now, what I'd like to do at the end is just have a bit of a bottom line takeaway, sort of key messages from this chat. What would you like to make sure people get into their heads?
I think obviously as you age, making sure that you take the opportunities to be as physically active as possible, being physically inactive is kind of, it has a really bad, negative effect on your metabolic health, but it's kind of very subtle, you don't notice it creeping up on you. So avoid sedentary behaviors as much as possible, and stay physically active, and try and socialize when you're physically active as well, and
and hopefully that would slow your mitochondrial mitochondria.
Mitochondrial mitochondrial health is critically important, not just to muscle metabolic health as we age, but other tissues and, you know, other disease states mitochondria are linked to. So they're really critical for overall, you know, human health, I think. So
actually, just when you're saying the mitochondria are linked to health, that old debate, that old sort of chestnut about whether mitochondria plays a role in insulin sensitivity or not, I guess that's been sort of going out.
Yeah, we're going to need another podcast to address that one, Glenn. I think that one's there's still a lot of debate around it. I would say individuals with low oxidative capacity in muscle, they're probably at a greater risk for developing insulin resistance and diabetes. You know, whether mechanistically mitochondria are linked to insulin resistance, I think there's some compelling data to suggest there are, related to ROS emission, related to dysfunctional fat oxidation in the mitochondria. But, you know, if John Halozzi was still with us, he'd argue the other way, I think. So, yeah, there's a lot of data out there to support either point of view on that one, I think.
And I guess on the takeaway is, okay, the mechanisms of interest are important, and we all sort of worry about it. But in terms of exercise, you know, a podcast about exercise, if you're going to exercise, you're going to improve your insulin sensitivity. Absolutely. And your mitochondrial function. So yes, whether it's chicken and egg or egg and chicken or whatever it is, or just both happening coincidentally, you're better off exercising. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Paul.
Thanks for having me on, Glenn. This has been fun.
Maybe I will take you up on another yeah, trip here. Well, actually, trip here. It's a bit strange, but I'm looking out the window and I'm not showing people because there's it's a virtual background. But, you know, when you talk about people being physically active here in Copenhagen, all I can see is bikes out the window here at the University of Copenhagen. Bikes everywhere. Have you been to Copenhagen?
I have, yeah. I'm actually going to be there in August for a week.
Okay.
I don't know if you'll still be there, will you?
I will be, yeah. I'll be there till, I'll be here till mid-November.
Okay.
Yeah, so
maybe we can meet up. Maybe the next podcast we can do a face-to-face one. That would be fun in Copenhagen.
Well, the funny thing is the last person I had on was Lars Nebo, and he was just down the corridor, but I've only have one camera, one microphone. I'm not set up. So he was in his office and I was in my office. So don't challenge me there technically.
Okay. But yeah, Copenhagen, beautiful city. And yeah, everybody's on bikes. It's wonderful to see, you know, what's possible in terms of keeping people physically active in cities like that. It's kind of it's a model, really. And, exactly. You know, I know my home city of Dublin in Ireland, they're trying to kind of, you know, there's more bike lanes now. They're trying to build the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And I think they're trying to model it based on, you know, Copenhagen, Amsterdam, these kind of bike friendly cities. So.
Well, we talked with Lars Nebo about that, and he was, he's actually an amazing cyclist. He just did 45 kilometers in an hour.
Wow.
Just pretty quick, and he's 50. But he was saying, even in Copenhagen, there's more and more, and I see it as well when I ride here in the morning, more and more people, you go, oh, they're fit, and then you realize they've got an electric bike. But yeah, the difference here is in Melbourne, people with electric bikes, they don't even bother pedaling. The people here, they actually pedal.
They pedal.
But the electric is supplementing it. You know, okay, like they don't just let the bike do everything. But he was lamenting how more and more electric bikes are out here. So anyway, well, there goes the light. So I think we are going to pull the lights. So thanks again for coming on, Paul. And
thanks, Ben.
Might see you in, what'd you say?
Might see you in August. I'll give you a shout, okay?
Great. Okay. See you, mate. Bye-bye. Yeah, bye. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.